Welcome to Future Makers, your invitation to cutting-edge debates on our changing society with leading thinkers from the University of Oxford and beyond. In Paris, on the 12th of December 2015, representatives of 196 states reached an agreement to combat climate change that was celebrated around the world, with the long-term goal of keeping global temperatures to below 2 degrees C above pre-industrial levels, and covering areas such as nationally determined contributions and global stocktakes, Paris was heralded as a huge breakthrough. But 4 years on, and against the backdrop of President Trump announcing his desire to withdraw from the agreement, what has the Paris Agreement actually achieved? Here with me today in Hertford College are Freddie Otto, Acting Director of Oxford's Environmental Change Institute and a lead scientist on the World Weather Attribution Initiative, Richard Miller, a senior analyst for the Committee on Climate Change, whose research spans the physical and economic consequences of climate policy, and Suganda Srivastav, a researcher on the Post-Carbon Transition Project at the Oxford Martin School, who's previously worked at the Indian Council for Research on International Economic Relations. Thank you all for coming and welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Freddie, perhaps I could start with you. In what context was the Paris Agreement signed? What had been tried before? Where had previous conversations led? And in summary, if possible, what are the main components of the agreement that was reached in 2015?
So before the Paris Agreement, there was the Kyoto Protocol, which was signed in 1997, and which at the time was an achievement because that had for the first time a goal, a temperature goal to limit global warming in there. But not all states had signed Kyoto. And also the Kyoto Protocol was very top down, so said in the protocol what all the states had to do. And so the Paris Agreement was, in that respect, very different because it's really a bottom-up approach where all the different nation states say what they are going to do themselves in terms of cutting emissions. And that's the national determined contributions. And also, the Paris Agreement has capped the 2-degree goal. It says we will pursue efforts to limit, or the goal is to limit global warming to 2 degrees, but it will pursue efforts to limit it to 1.5 degrees. And also the Paris Agreement said that to stop warming at whatever temperature goal actually, there needs to be net zero emissions. So that the net zero and the 1.5 and the bottom up are, I think, the huge achievements in Paris compared to what was there before.
Thank you, Freddie. Can you expand just a bit more on the top-down versus bottom-up, because it's talked about as an agreement, but then as you describe bottom-up, it sounds like the countries are deciding for themselves what they're going to agree to.
Well, they are not deciding for themselves what they're going to agree to. They have agreed to limit warming to 2 degrees and preferably to 1.5 degrees, and they have agreed to achieve net zero. But what they are deciding for, but what each country is deciding for themselves is how they are going to do that. So the principle behind that is the common but differentiated responsibility. That means that because, of course, all the different countries have different historic responsibility in terms of how much they have emitted historically, and of course they have different means depending on their economic development. But with this approach, each country can say what they think they can do within their economic and social means in their country. And it will be reviewed every 5 years. So that is the global stocktake. So the first one is due in 2023, where then the parties will review, okay, given the goals that all the countries have set, or the ambitions they have set, where are we with respect to global temperatures? Where are we with respect to limiting emissions? And then the idea is that they will then have different NDCs, so different national determined contributions, depending on how close they are to the goal. And the only thing that is in the Paris Agreement of what how these goals or these national determined contributions should be is that they should be ambitious, and, which is also important, that the so-called Annex I states, so the historically developed countries, that they should lead with their ambitions.
Thank you. Richard, do you think this is a mechanism that can be relied on? Because somebody might well say, OK, it was agreed in 2015 that these things should be done. There's a global stock take in 2023, that's 8 years later. Doesn't sound like a very strong enforcement mechanism. What do you think?
Yeah, so I think the real achievement of Paris is actually putting in place the framework. And some of it's quite boring in some ways because it does set these targets, the right targets, as Freddie's talked about trying to keep warming well below 2 degrees and ideally pursue efforts to 1.5. But it doesn't necessarily have the compatible ambition on how fast we're going to reduce emissions as a globe to do that. But I think while that was acknowledged from the outset at the Paris Agreement, having this structure in place is really important. And the work that's been done over the last few years since 2015 has been to really flesh out what this agreement meant and sort of fill in what's called the rule book to actually operationalize this. And again, that's a lot of quite technocratic, technical discussions between different countries at these annual meetings. Doesn't get the same headlines that sort of big pledges to increase emissions have done, but it was something that was really necessary, and we're pretty much there now on that. There's a few areas left to close out, but we kind of have a fully operational Paris Agreement. Now, of course, what we need to see is people step up on the ambition side, and the next big test of that is going to be the end of next year, where under the protocol that accepted the Paris Agreement at COP21 in Paris, there was a commitment from all the countries to both increase their ambition for their emissions reductions to 2030, these nationally determined contributions or NDCs that we've already been talking about, and to produce a long-term strategy for the mid-century of how we're going to get to this goal to actually balance the sources and sinks of greenhouse gases, which is ultimately what the world's going to need to achieve the goal of stabilizing or reducing temperatures at any level, if that's below 2 degrees, 1.5 or whatever. So I think a lot of the background's in place, and I think that was the real achievement of Paris. And now it's a real test of, can we make this so-called ratchet mechanism, this sort of steady increase in ambition is going to be expected from countries over time. Can we make that work? And that's what we're going to find out next year.
Thank you. Can you expand a little bit more on, you talked about a rule book and annual meetings. How do those work? What sort of rules are we talking about?
Sure. So the meeting that this all gets discussed at is what's called the COP, so the Conference of Parties. So COP21 was the 21st meeting of the Conference of Parties to the UN framework that deals with climate change.
And the parties here are what? All the different countries?
Yeah, they're all different countries, but also there's observer organisations, NGOs, academics. But yeah, essentially the main players around the table are the national sovereign governments and entities like EU, which represent wider groupings of countries.
And these are annual?
Yeah, they're annual. So we've had five now since COP21. COP25 is this year in Chile. And at each of these, we've been chipping away at the rule book. So sort of fleshing out the details of what the sort of high level principles of the Paris Agreement text actually means in terms of making this work.
Can you give some examples?
Yeah. So for example, in Poland last year, we closed on most of the rule book, which included things like rules to better harmonise these nationally determined contributions,
right.
So how much countries are going to reduce emissions by 2030, and how to compare them across different countries. They're still not perfect, but we've improved on that. One area where we're still actually working, and it's an important area where it's important that the rules that are finally agreed are strong, is on market mechanisms. So this is trading emissions between countries, trading efforts between different parts of the world, and that's an area that's still live. There still hasn't been an agreement yet. It's hopeful that we'll reach one maybe at COP25 this year in December. So it's things like that, really, that actually make these sort of high-level principles of increasing ambition, the temperature goals, all this sort of thing, and the broader agenda, which I think we're going to move on, you know, finance and adaptation and how it actually turns these things into stuff that's actionable and also allows governments to be held account more by other governments, but also by civil society.
So at the moment, are there not clear mechanisms for holding governments to account?
So I think it varies around the world. So while we've discussed at the outset about how these contributions are nationally determined, they are brought by countries, and there's no mechanism to force a country to have a certain target. But to use the UK as an example, the targets that we're bringing and talking about in the international fora, within the EU at the moment, but you know, potentially as independent UK post leaving the EU, these are enshrined in national law. So those are, you know, the government is accountable under the Climate Change Act. The organisation I work for, the Committee on Climate Change, is part of the mechanism to hold government to account on how it's going to achieve these targets and to advise on where they need to be strengthened, for instance, as we've just done in the recent advice to set a net zero target in the UK. So it does depend on national entities to translate these targets from the COP, from the Paris process, into national law. And I think that's just a feature of the Paris Agreement that we have to live with, really, having this bottom-up structure, this non sort of legally binding, in the sense that it doesn't legally bind you into specific emissions cuts, was necessary to get this agreement in the first place. And yeah, it ultimately comes down to, can this process of this multilateral process of everyone coming together, trying to collectively increase our ambition on all these different fronts, can it actually work?
It's a much more subtle arrangement and structure than Kyoto, from the sound of it. I mean, the bottom up. Suganda, I mean, do you think the reporting about the agreement, the way it was seen around the world, was that overly optimistic?
Well, I think, as Freddie and Richard have discussed, Paris offered a chance to reboot climate diplomacy. So just taking a look at the past, there was a lot of pessimism around Kyoto. We had notable events such as Canada absolutely pulling out to avoid some fees. The US also pulled out of Kyoto. And we were at a moment where there was a lot of pessimism about international climate diplomacy. So in 2015, when Paris came about, it was a big win because it was this moment where countries came together and put forth a target, and island nations particularly lobbied for the 1.5 clause. And it was a huge success for them that that was included. So I think it flipped the dynamic of international climate diplomacy. And one of the very interesting things that I observed, being from a developing country myself, is that you had leaders from India and China say that they will unilaterally take action on climate change. And that is a big difference from them in the past talking about how they need to grow in the same way that Britain grew during the Industrial Revolution. So we're seeing a new dynamic at play. So I am quite optimistic, and I think some of the reporting picked up on the optimism. Of course, this is now shadowed by some of the announcements that Donald Trump has made. At the same time, though, we have to acknowledge that while Donald Trump said at the national level US is going to withdraw, you had several US states, including California, that said they're still going to adhere to it. And you had a lot of companies that also said they're going to adhere to it. So even just setting aside nation states, there's this subnational surge of action with cities, municipalities taking strong climate action.
I think what Richard just said and what you just said, that is also one very, very important part of the Paris Agreement, that it just doesn't talk about nation states. And Richard said that the national determined contributions, they are not in the Paris Agreement, they are in the nations. But once the nations have set their targets, they are actually accountable. And we have seen that in the Netherlands, for example, that in a court case that's called the Urgenda case, that actually the Dutch government has been held accountable by their own citizens to adhere to their own targets, which they hadn't done, because they have said that that's what they are going to do. And so an NGO and a group of citizens have sued their own government because they have not done enough, that they actually reached their own targets, and they won. And then the state appealed. But in the appeal, the NGO has won again. And so that's one way of how the Paris Agreement can be very powerful.
And it sounds like it's not only setting targets or inspiring targets, at any rate, from nation states, but also, you were saying, Suganda from California, for example. And are other organisations also doing this?
Cities are playing a big role. So there is a group of cities that are talking as sort of part of the COP and setting their own targets and their own goals, and in different contexts. So in Australia, there was another court case where people wanted to stop from a new coal mine to be opened. And the judge in that case, his ruling why this case was won was that he said, well, Australia has signed up to the Paris Agreement. And the Paris Agreement says that the Annex One countries, so the developed countries, are leading in their ambitions. And so whatever your arguments may be of, oh, it's better if we burn the coal in Australia than somewhere else in the world or wherever, that is just completely irrelevant because the rich countries like Australia have to lead the way in their ambitions. And Australia has signed the agreement, so you can't dig up more coal. That's quite a powerful way how this agreement is also outside the big negotiations, actually quite powerful.
Right, so countries can make their own promises, but having made them, they're being held to them. Yeah, that's interesting. Richard?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's also important to remember that there's a lot of discussion around the mitigation side of the Paris Agreement and these temperature goals. But it's a much more holistic framework than that. There are two other long-term goals. There's a goal on adaptation, adapting to the changes that are coming, but also a goal on climate finance. And this is something that I think, at least in this part of the world, it's easy to forget that this goal to mobilise financial flows so they're consistent with low carbon sustainable development around the world, and particularly the responsibility on the developed countries to provide most of these flows. You know, there's this target of getting to $100 billion a year in climate finance flows by 2020 and moving to higher levels after that. That's, I think, almost as an important part of the Paris Agreement as the mitigation side, and something when we think about what countries are doing, but also what states, what businesses, what individual organisations are doing to contribute to it. We have to think about those parts of it at the same time.
And the financial targets here, are we talking about finance going from rich countries to poorer countries to enable them to implement anti-climate change technology and that sort of thing?
Yeah, and it's about transferring technology to both help reduce emissions and to try and ensure that the developing parts of the world don't have to follow the same trajectory that we have in Europe, for instance, that they can kind of hopefully leapfrog to low carbon sustainable development pathways. But also it's for the adaptation side as well. It's to try and help provide funding to ensure that the changes in climate that we know are coming, that are happening today, can be adapted to as best as possible.
Suganda.
And I think one other element of the Paris Agreement that I find fascinating but slightly upsetting is the fact that if you search the text of the Paris Agreement, you don't find fossil fuels explicitly mentioned. And of course, it's implicitly there in the 2-degree target and even 1.5 degrees. It's implicitly understood that we need to quit our fossil fuel habit by switching to renewables or by capturing the emissions that come from fossil fuels, but it is not explicitly stated. And I think an important element is to realize some of the contradictions in what countries pursue. So on one hand, while countries give subsidies for renewables and promote renewable energy technologies, they are simultaneously excavating coal or importing oil or importing goods that have been produced in countries that have an energy system based on coal. That if we take the example for Germany itself, Germany has massive lignite mines, and there's been a lot of legal action against these. But I think it's notable that explicitly in the text of the Paris Agreement, fossil fuels are not mentioned. And I think there could be some benefits in the narrative and the discussions if fossil fuels were explicitly mentioned.
Why do you think they weren't mentioned? Was that in order to get agreement?
Yes, of course. I mean, there are many important countries that have a lot of influence and whose economies fundamentally depend on fossil fuels. Paris adopted a technology neutral stance. You know, it didn't say we have to regulate out fossil fuels. It left open a door for negative emissions technologies such as carbon capture and storage. But at the same time, it's the elephant in the room because we know that the business model of fossil fuel companies fundamentally has to change. Either they call themselves energy companies and they diversify their portfolio and invest in renewables or other technologies, or they invest a lot in carbon capture and storage, make it economical. But fundamentally, this business model has to change.
It sounds to me as though the news from Paris isn't as good as it initially sounded. There might be quite a lot going on which is pointing in the wrong direction. I mean, a country can be doing some things that look really good and meeting their commitments. On the other hand, they're digging up coal.
The devil's in the details. Right. So, I think some notable issues here are Guyana, which discovered massive amounts of offshore oil reserves. Mozambique is another one. And we have the situation where you have very poor countries discovering reserves that they hope to use for their development. And you have the IMF, on the other hand, recommending establishing sovereign wealth funds to manage this properly. So there is a dissonance, there's a tension. But as Richard said, if we make alternatives affordable, and if carbon capture and storage is properly invested in and becomes cheap and affordable, then we can find a way out. But I am not sure if we're at the stage where these business models are being challenged enough.
Okay.
We're not. We're not. But I think you said Paris is pointing in the wrong direction. And I think that's maybe a bit of an unfair way to frame it, because Paris is certainly not perfect, but I think it's definitely pointing in the right direction. There are a lot of things that should be better and could be better, but I think it's the right way forward, because before that, we just had not the states just not doing anything. And now they especially as a German, it's very embarrassing, because they are really doing very stupid things and not leading the way in terms of ambitions. But I think it's still pointing that Paris is still in the right direction as a whole.
So it sounds like it's not a straightforward picture with Paris. It's ironing out some wrinkles, but then others are appearing elsewhere.
Yes, I think that's very much the case. And I can give a few examples to highlight this point. So, for example, in Brazil, they had a commitment for solid reforestation. But as we're seeing now with the new government that's come into power, there has been deforestation, and evidence has also shown that the rate of fires has increased significantly. Not to mention the fact with some of the new forest codes, you could completely undo some of their reforestation commitments. So you have policy flip-flops happening. And even if we go to the developed world and consider California, for example, California is an absolute leader in many climate policies. It's set very stringent energy efficiency standards. It is a solar PV leader. But at the same time, it issued 20,000 new permits to expand domestic oil and gas production. And finally, coming to Norway, which was one of the first countries to actually put a tax on carbon back in the 90s, we all know that Norway has offshore oil production, and even recently this has expanded. So I would say that what we need is policy consistency. Paris is definitely on the right track, but we need to ensure that all of our policies come together to push in one direction. These contradictions send mixed signals to markets.
Yeah. It's a very complex picture, isn't it? I mean, sounding initially as though Paris very nicely was moving on from Kyoto with this bottom-up approach and bringing in more aspects and finding a rather subtle but nice way of bringing the nations forward together. But it sounds like a more complicated picture.
Well, I think it definitely is a complicated picture. But one thing I actually wanted to come back to is what Richard was saying earlier. Paris is not just about emissions and mitigation. In the Paris Agreement, there's also a lot about adaptation. And actually, that is also part of the national determined contribution. They don't only say what countries do in terms of mitigation, but they also are going to say what they will do in terms of adaptation. And what is new in Paris compared to everything that has been before? Before Paris, at the COPs, the discussion have been sort of in two pillars, one about mitigation and one around adaptation.
So mitigation is reducing the amount of global warming.
Yes.
And so, adaptation is adapting what we do so that we can cope with the greater heat.
Has always been understood sort of within the future. So adapt to the climate change that will happen in the future. But what is new in the Paris Agreement is that there is a third pillar, and that's loss and damage. So because, of course, we already have 1 degree of global warming now, and there are impacts of climate change now. There are people dying because of climate change now. There are huge economic and non-economic losses that are incurred because of climate change. And that is now recognized in the Paris Agreement in Article 8. It says that that loss and damage is an issue. What is also one of the difficult things is that it is actually nowhere defined what loss and damage means. And it's deliberately not defined, because if it was defined, then there would not have been the agreement. But of course, if you haven't defined what you actually mean by loss and damage, it's very hard to do something about it.
Is there a suggestion within the agreement that loss and damage should be compensated for?
No, the opposite. So there is actually in the annex to the agreement, there is an article that says that loss and damage is not compensation. So it defines what it's not about, but it doesn't say what it's then about. And of course, that is already a big step, because it recognizes that there is loss and damage. And this recognition is important. And this is something, well, Richard was talking about the rule book. And while the rule book has made a lot of progress on the mitigation side, I think it's still very difficult to decide for a country, okay, we have loss and damage and it's not about compensation, but what do we actually do with this? And for some countries, this is really important. So Bangladesh, for example, they have said, okay, climate change is having a huge impact on this, on our country now. So we can't wait until we have a sort of an international agreement on that. And maybe then maybe some financial help, even if we don't call it compensation. So we have to do something. And so Bangladesh has said, okay, we set some of our own government funds aside for a loss and damage fund for Bangladesh.
But what effect does recognizing it in the agreement have? I mean, is it just providing Bangladesh with, say, more moral force when they say, look, you all acknowledge that this damage to our country has come about through global warming, to which we were very small contributors?
Which is a big thing, I would say. It actually not. So Bangladesh is a country where they have said, okay, it's so important for us that we have to set up our own mechanism because it will take too long for there to be a global one.
But the idea is that there will be a global mechanism in the end to compensate or to somehow help
not
countries.
Not to compensate, definitely not to compensate.
Right, not to compensate.
But to help countries to deal with loss and damage, yes.
Right.
But at the moment, it's not really decided how that will look like.
Yeah, okay. Richard?
Yeah, and I think that's really relevant for thinking about what we do with financial flows. And it can be easy to think that the quote-unquote sexy options are funding things that are helping reduce emissions. But I think it's really important that we actually think about also financing adaptation projects in the parts of the world that are, as Freddie said, feeling the impacts the most today that we're already experiencing. And yeah, that's, I think, a really relevant thing for bearing in mind in how we hold governments in Europe, in Americas, to account on what they're doing in the broadest sense of contributing to the Paris Agreement.
Suganda.
And just one thing to highlight is that the 2 degree increase is a global average. So really, when we talk of countries in South Asia or others around the equatorial regions or islands, this is more than 2 degrees. And I think those impacts around the developing world have already been felt. We've seen that there have already been wars over water scarcity that's been induced by climate change. There's a whole literature on climate change and conflict. And so I think it's important when we talk about impacts, it's not just the physical impacts or the economic impacts. There's a whole host of social impacts through increased conflict, stress on institutional structures, and even increased disease burden. So I think this is a very real problem which is happening today. And unfortunately, in some parts of South Asia where I'm from, it's impacting people in and around regions that I know.
Well, it is always impacting, or those who pay for the loss and damage now, it's always the poor people. Whether it globally, it's the poor people, but also in every country, also in the US, the hurricanes that we've seen recently in the Gulf of Mexico, the rainfall amounts have been more intense because of man-made climate change. And the people who are impacted by that most dramatically are not the ones who have insurance and who have the big, rich houses. They are the ones who couldn't afford insurance before and certainly will never be able to afford insurance now.
I mean, so two thoughts occur to me. One is it's fairly early days, really, after the Paris Agreement. It's not been that long. But was Paris ambitious enough? We've got all these problems that are occurring. Maybe they were already going to occur, whatever happened at Paris. But maybe Paris could have been more ambitious, or maybe countries are simply not keeping up with the commitments they said they would. I mean, Richard, what's the picture around the globe about how far nations have followed their commitments?
Yeah, so it's certainly a really complex picture and really different in different parts of the world. But I think the first thing to say is, you know, we are changing course as a globe. You know, we are moving away from the highest carbon business as usual pathways. I think, you know, in the best estimate of the climate response to these emissions, the business as usual pathways, like continuing to burn ever more fossil fuels, would get us to 4 to 5 degrees in the best estimate, potentially much higher if the climate response turns out to be on the worst end, I guess, of the possibilities that the science indicates that it might be today. And the actions we have seen so far that are moving towards implementing these pledges, we're sort of pushing where we're that moving that expectation of where global temperatures might be down to towards 3 degrees, or pathways consistent with around 3 degrees. So we're making some progress there. We're not on track for the temperature goals, and there's still a little gap to actually get between where policies and actions that actually are being implemented today and what governments have said. But we can close that gap, and I think over the next year we hope to see that gap close entirely, but also the ambition of the pledges themselves step up much more strongly and try and get much closer towards the pathways that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change looked at that might keep us below 2 degrees and hopefully with a good chance of getting below 1.5.
So you're talking there in terms of we, but in reality there's lots of different countries, and some of them are probably doing quite well and some rather less well. Can you name some names?
I think it's really difficult to even decide what is doing well, I think. And I think we have to come at this with a view that this common but differentiated responsibilities that we talked about at the outset, how each countries have, you know, this common obligation to try and reduce emissions. But some have had really high carbon historical development, so much richer than others. So what is an acceptable amount to be done by different countries is going to vary between them. And there's going to be lots of different perspectives on that. Something that is happening at the moment, I think we're seeing internationally, is a movement and some momentum around developed countries setting a target for mid-century of reaching net zero emissions by or before mid-century. I think we're sort of seeing a bit of a, you know, coalescing around that. So for instance, the UK has set that target, France has set that target, the EU's considering that target. That's sort of starting to push the envelope at what might be able to, how fast we could get emissions down in these countries. But I think the whole part of it being a global agreement is it really is going to require a step up from everybody. The highest possible ambition, which is a phrase that's used within the Paris Agreement for how we should be approaching setting these targets, has to apply everywhere. And that's going to mean different things in a country like China or India than it is in the UK. But it is still absolutely necessary for us to get anywhere near these targets. In 2020, we're going to have to see Europe and the rest of the developed countries step up into this space and make sure that we're confident we're going to go there, but also then use some diplomatic pressure along with the rest of the world to make everyone increase their pledges.
Freddie?
Well, you were asking, was Paris ambitious enough? And I think Paris is ambitious enough because it says 2 degrees, 1.5 degrees, net zero. That's what we want. But not all the nations are ambitious enough. And I think particularly in a country like Germany, who's super rich, who is one of the historic big contributors, where actually the current national government is really pulling, having a very weak aim and their goals and then watering it down and are actually less ambitious than the population wanted to be. And I think that the latter is actually what makes me hopeful again, because while the national governments might really not be ambitious enough, especially in the countries that should lead in ambition, but a lot, thanks to the Fridays for Futures movement and so on, the populations are actually wanting more ambition from their governments. And so there were polls in Germany recently that the majority wants the government to be more ambitious. Why they still feel they can't be that is beyond me, but I think that...
Is it because of key workers losing their jobs and industries closing down? And I mean, if they've got a lot of investment mines...
It's because of imaginary yellow vests. And and I would say also lobbyism from a country that has basically been ruled by the car industry for ever.
Right. I see. Okay. I mean, so one question that comes up here is regarding the tracking of progress, because we've got a very complex situation here with countries all setting their own targets. And I can see how in some countries it might be that pressure from the population is itself enough to keep them on track, to make sure their politicians are supporting things and so on. But overall, when you've got a very complex picture like this, if there is some country which is trying to, if you like, weasel out of it, it's very difficult, isn't it, to point the finger when the targets are so distributed and different. And what mechanisms are there for tracking progress and highlighting failure to achieve what they should? Sukanda.
So there is something called a Carbon Tracker Initiative, which has made some attempt at doing this. And essentially what it does is it applies the common but differentiated principle and checks up how the nationally determined contributions stack up. So essentially you have some countries that get a very poor score. They are still pursuing fossil fuels, and they essentially have targets that are based on a business as usual trajectory. So to make that clear, that says in 2030, we'll reduce emissions by 15% compared to what they would be under a no climate scenario, no climate action scenario. And to be frank, most of these business as usual scenarios inflate the amount of emissions that would have happened. And this is actually a big problem. So most of the countries that have this type of target are given quite a poor score. Sometimes the target is conditional on receiving international finance. So like Richard was saying, it's actually quite hard to compare, but some efforts have been made. And I think Carbon Tracker Initiative is an interesting one.
Who decides what score they get?
So this initiative essentially has a team of economists and scientists coming together
from lots of different countries.
Well, I'm not sure of their nationality composition,
right,
so I'm not going to comment on that.
Okay.
I think one of the challenging points that you hit on there, Sukanda, is that with this range of ways in which the targets are formulated, whether they're percentage reductions from some business as usual trajectory, all sorts of different ways, improvements in carbon intensity, absolute emissions reductions, there's a whole set of them out there. But even given that, there's still a challenge in comparing them, because you might say a country is on track to achieve its target, but that might just indicate that the target's really weak and could be done really easily and should be strengthened. And a country that has a tough target, it might not be on track to achieve it yet, but is moving in the right direction. You know, it's tough to know how to compare those exactly. But I think this is the world we're going to be in, and it's important that we have these kind of initiatives that look at this and try and take a view and make that public so other people can say, oh, do I agree with that view or not? And ultimately, this is going to be done through the fora of the UN process as well, and the countries are going to come together in things like the global stocktake, but more regularly as well, to say, this is our pledge, here's why we think it's a fair pledge. Do you agree with that? And they're going to receive strong pushback from different countries on that they don't think it goes far enough. And they're ultimately going to have to defend it. And hopefully, if this process works, it will enable us to shift these pledges and to ever more move in the right direction. And it'll be a really messy way of doing that. And there's going to be a whole set of other interests going on in the background, wider geopolitical considerations. But that's the real world. And it's not going to be as clean as we might imagine it to be.
So we're kind of making the best of a bad job. We've got a world in which we can't get all our politicians to agree for the good of the planet. So we do things in this slightly messy but perhaps optimistic way. Yes.
But one note of optimism, again, is the fact that there's a lot of co-benefits from reducing emissions, and one of them happens to be air pollution, which a lot of countries in the developing world are focusing on. When you look at sort of the smog around Asian metropolises and you read the news, this is something that is really in the public discourse now. And that yields a lot of no-regrets policies that help reduce emissions and at the same time deliver tangible benefits to the local population. And at the same time, renewables are much cheaper than they were 10 years ago. So I think one note of optimism is that the case for unilateral action is becoming stronger as alternatives become cheaper and as the damages become greater.
Yeah, that's rather important, isn't it? Because a notorious problem with getting climate change agreement has been countries are reluctant to commit themselves unless they see other countries committing. Why should we?
And
America has been a particular country in which that idea has been made quite a lot of. I mean, I'd be interested to know what is the position with America, because they're not perhaps under the same pressures as the countries you've just mentioned to unilaterally reduce their emissions. We've got a president there who's not a great friend of the Paris Agreement.
Well, I think facts are facts, and some of the facts are that renewable energy actually does employ a lot of people within the U.S. itself. Another fact is that the U.S. is facing the burden of climate change, and some areas will face climate change impacts.
Do you mean with regard to the weather?
Exactly. The U.S. is not immune from extreme weather events, nor is it immune from the economic impacts that are associated with it. And a lot of businesses, frankly, realize this. So if we are in a world where you have assets that get stranded in the future, you can't use your coal assets anymore because there's a global commitment, shareholders will ultimately lose value. We're also in a world where actually real estate along coastal zones may not be profitable anymore because those zones are at risk of flooding events. So the economics is changing. Now, whether the president realizes this or not is a different question, but businesses are certainly realizing that the economics is changing.
And are you talking here about coastal cities? Is it sea level rise or extreme events or the combination of both?
The combination of both.
And how confident can we be with regard to extreme events being the result of global warming?
We are. So when it comes to the rainfall amount associated with hurricanes and tropical storms, the flooding associated with it is responsible for a lot of the damages. We are very confident that climate change increased the intensity of this rainfall and the likelihood of them to occur. So the latest study that we with our World Weather Attribution Initiative, where we look at exactly that, at extreme events that have just happened and the role of climate change in them, with the tropical storm Imelda, which hit Texas, the likelihood of such flooding to occur was doubled because of climate change.
And there we're talking about, what, the average heat in the atmosphere or something like that, are we?
No, we are talking about how climate change, the warming itself, but also the associated changes in atmospheric circulation and so on. So everything what climate change means has changed the likelihood and intensity of that event to occur.
Right. And this is uncontroversial, is it? All I'm wondering is, you get in America, you've got a lot of denialism, and they will say, oh, the computer model just says this.
Yeah, but they say that about global warming overall.
Right.
And they say that, well, CO2 is a good thing. And so in the same way, yeah, it's controversial. If that's controversial, then of course everything else is controversial. But no, it's just part of climate science, and it's something where there has been huge scientific development in the last years, mainly thanks to now having more computer power so that we are actually able to look with climate models as at extreme events as well as at mean warming. We're not confident for hailstorm because that's something that we can't measure very well, neither in observations nor with climate models. But where the things where we have reliable models and where we have good measurements, we can confidently make these statements.
I think what we see the world over, and certainly in America, is people getting that this is about sensible risk management in some ways, that there are these risks that they're seeing, and they can see and notice that things are changing and that there are things we can do that help offset these risks. And I think businesses, different levels of organization within the states get that. And I think it's also worth stressing that it's in some ways amazing that we're at the point where doing some of the things, not everything, but some of the things that are going to help reduce our emissions is just going to be a cheaper and better way of doing it. So, for instance, driving cars, it's just going to be cheaper to drive an electric car before too long, you know, that you'd be silly not to, just on a cost perspective. Same with electricity, you know, renewables in most parts of the world are now likely to be the cheapest form of generating electricity. These are things that you will just want to do because they make good business sense. I think we are seeing bits of that in America. Of course, that won't get us the whole way. There are hard things to do, and that will require policy action. But it does give me hope, at least, that large bits of the world can start this journey to moving their emissions down and to try and adapt to these risks in ways that makes sense.
Is this what's made Paris possible? Because, I mean, a major problem about all these agreements is that typically there's the free rider problem. It would be nice if everybody else reduced their emissions, but I'm going to carry on taking advantage of fossil fuels. And it's hard to stop people cheating in that context. Whereas if you move to a situation where everyone individually benefits, much, much easier. You're nodding, Suganda. You think that's a big change. Right, okay. So does that mean then that if America pulls out of the agreement, as President Trump is threatening, that won't actually wreck it? It can still succeed despite that?
Yes. So there's a lot of dynamics at work. And one is that the cost structure, as Richard was saying, has changed. So the incentives are totally different. In fact, if America leaves it, it risks losing out on very fruitful technology collaborations, or there are even reputational costs of actually withdrawing from an agreement where there are benefits. And I think where America is missing out on an opportunity is to really be a leader. And we do need countries to spearhead coordination efforts. So to give an example, Europe has been able to integrate a lot of renewable energy because of an interconnected grid. Renewables are volatile, but if the grid across countries is interconnected, then when Spain is sunny and the UK is windy, this sort of energy can be transferred to a place which has no sun or no wind. Similarly, in the ASEAN region, Southeast Asia, there are plans for an interconnected grid there that would really help with renewables integration, and that's part of the conversations. So we are seeing regional leaders emerge that are spearheading these efforts for regional cooperation where everyone wins. People in ASEAN want an interconnected grid to address energy shortage problems, to utilize, sunny parts in other regions. This is a win-win case.
To avoid all that pollution.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think there's a lot to lose from not being part of such an effort.
I think that is really one thing that Paris, the agreement, realizes, if not very explicitly, but also explicitly, is that, the impact of climate change are felt locally, they need to be dealt with locally, but also actually the changes that we need to do for mitigation need to be implemented locally. Of course, there needs to be national legislation, but I think the recognition that it's not all about the nation states is a big step forward. And I think one thing that we really need to do also, and with we, I mean also as scientists and everyone, is talking about, actually, implementing mitigation measures makes life better. It's not about losing something that you held dear, but it actually makes life better. And I think we talk way too little about that.
One thing that's always cropped up in these discussions is the issue of fairness between countries and the fact that countries like Britain, like America, have belched out loads of fossil fuels in the past and gained a lot of economic development as a result. And maybe the onus should be on us to lead the way in reduction. That seems like quite a forceful argument. But if actually nations are largely doing this from self-interest because there are clear benefits, how much impact does that sort of argument play in the current state of things, Richard?
Yeah, I think it's important. It's an important part of the principles of the Paris Agreement, and we have to take it seriously because it's true that a country like the UK was one of the first to start on this industrialization journey. But at the same time, I think we need to view this in a much broader definition of what leadership means, touching on the things we just talked about. When we looked at this as part of the advice from the Committee on Climate Change to the UK government on setting a net zero target, we looked at different ways of splitting out the global effort, and you concluded that there are a whole range of them. They give you slightly different answers, but it's clear that they all point to the UK doing more than the average. And that's important to do that. But it's also important for the reasons we talked about, to be able to move as part of a group of countries doing this together, to gain some of these benefits from developing these technologies, which then have spillover effects on helping the rest of the world do it faster. And also think that we've got to be really aware that this is not going to be like a single like Kodak moment where we've done all this and it's sorted. It's going to be long, and it's going to require to bring people with us for years, potentially decades at a time. And I think what that actually means is that you do need to set ambitious targets, absolutely, that recognize these kind of issues that we're talking about. But it's also really important that it's credible. And you can set out not just a target, but a pathway to doing that, put in place real policies that bind you into doing things in the near term that actually get you moving down this trajectory, to show that we mean it when we set these targets. We will do it and we will carry through with it. And doing that, I think, requires both the sense of this international leadership and fairness, but also fairness internally as well, understanding the just transition, these issues around who's going to be the losers, which sectors are going to have to shrink, which ones might grow, where those are located in the country. And it's important, I think, now as we sort of not starting this journey, but really, you know, focusing on how we get from where we are here in the UK to net zero by 2050, to think now about how do we tackle these issues to make sure that we can bring people with us over the next 30 years.
Sugandha.
Another thing I want to touch upon is often when we talk about fairness, it's always between and across countries. But of course, it's very important to consider fairness within countries. And we have a whole literature in economics about designing policies so that they're progressive. That means that the poorest are not hit very hard, while the richest pay most of the costs associated. So it's very important to translate our learnings on progressive designs and make sure that climate policies don't hit the poorest the hardest. So I think that's an important principle. But another maybe philosophical principle is to get the polluters to pay for what they do. I mean, we're already fed up of bailing out banks because of the financial crisis. The last thing we want to do is bail out the polluters, right? So I think there is this strong sense that those who are responsible for this pollution need to be held accountable. And as Freddie was saying, you know, there are court cases now where people are taking certain companies to court for their historical emissions or for their current plans of mining expansion. So I think fairness occurs on many levels. And if I come back to the country level, I think Richard's point on finance is absolutely essential. There needs to be this financial flow from the developed world to the developing world, focusing particularly on the poorest in the developing world.
One point I was trying to make before, which is really relevant about this fairness, is that the Paris Agreement and how it's implemented in the country, it really requires a lot of explaining and a lot of communication, and we need to find, I think, to really make it powerful and to really take the people with us or with the leadership on this. We really need to get better at explaining how that actually the financial measures we might take or the economic measures we might take to achieve our goals, how they benefit the poor, how they make life better for certain regions that might feel they are really hard done by. And I think that is something where we maybe have not thought enough about how we do that nationally, but also in cities or with businesses. So I think that is actually one of the really key factor to make it a powerful agreement.
That would resonate with many people, the idea that the rich should pay most and the poor pay less for something that's going to benefit everybody. But many people will say, climate change, that is being harnessed as a political tool. And this is a political question about, you know, whether the rich should help the poor and so forth. Within a country, we're used to that. We have progressive taxation. But you were talking, Suganda, about the rich countries paying the poor countries. Many people are going to say this is making it a political rather than a scientific issue.
Well, I think climate change is a social issue because just the impacts are felt by the most vulnerable, but not just by the most vulnerable globally, but also in every country. So I think climate change is not a scientific issue. It's not just about the physical impacts, it's the social impacts. But I think what you said earlier, that the rich should pay and the poor will win, that is always how it will be phrased. But just because the rich sort of start investing and first and starting to implement more stringent mitigation measures and invest in technology, that doesn't mean that they will then actually be worse off afterwards. If you think about that as a business point of view, well, if you as a business invest in technology and are actually leading the market, then you actually win as well. So I think that that is always the wrong analogy that's made. Oh, we're all socialists because the rich should be out of money. But when you just say that the rich should start and lead with ambition, that just doesn't mean that they will lose.
And, you know, to add to that, I mean, there is a clear self-interest in rich countries financing mitigation in poorer countries, because in rich countries, mitigation is often more expensive. I mean, they've already done all the low-hanging fruit. At this point, they need to invest in costly technologies for each extra ton of carbon that's mitigated. So, I mean, setting politics aside, there's a self-interest here. And going back to Freddie's communication point, we need to convey the fact that it is in your self-interest to finance mitigation in developing worlds. It is frankly cheaper. And on the question of just markets, I mean, markets are not perfect. I'm saying that as an economist, right? We have to be real and we need intervention. So this is how it is.
I often find quite helpful to think about this is it's going to be a new way of growing our economy. You know, it doesn't have to be any worse, and in some ways it's going to be a lot better for everyone. You know, from the modeling, the economics, a lot of it indicates that doing these things could actually well be a net benefit to the economy when you throw in all the things that are going to come with it, the sort of cleaner air, better environments, better cities. But also, you know, if we think about in the UK or other similar countries, developing these technologies and having this potential access, this global export market where we can sell these technologies and, you know, export them, that are going to have benefits there, but also benefits to businesses here. So I think there are a lot of win-wins, and I think it is important that we probably speak about it more and not speak about it as something that's going to be really painful for us to do here in the UK. I think the truth is actually the opposite more than is the case. And I think that's something that everyone can get on board with, hopefully.
Well, thank you very much. That's been a fascinating discussion. I'd be grateful if you could just sum up where we are with Paris, the good things about it, the things that maybe aren't so good. It seems to be going in the right direction. Is it going fast enough? And when will we know? What are the milestones? Is it that 2023 global stocktake, or are there others? Richard?
Yeah, so I do think it is going in the right direction. I think this stuff about establishing this framework, while it is quite boring, which I've said already to a lot of viewers from the outside, I think it is really important that we have this, we have the rule book. And again, I think this knowing that every degree of warming matters, which is one of the messages that came out of the recent IPCC special report on 1.5 degrees. If we think about it in that context, you know, everything we can do to help continue this journey that the world started to take in moving away from business as usual. And yes, we're not on track yet to achieve the actual temperature goals, keeping well below 2 degrees that the Paris Agreement sets out. But every little bit of the step towards that really matters and has real benefits for the climate that we're going to experience and the climates that's going to persist for thousands of years afterwards. So I think that's really important. And going through this process that's messy, but does move us down on the steps towards those lower warming worlds is really important. And I think real test of that in terms of milestones coming up is going to be at the end of 2020, where we have
2020.
End of 2020. So this is be the 26th Conference of the Parties. It's going to be held in Glasgow here in the UK. And this is the point where the parties, all of them, have to come back to the UN fora and bring with them new pledges for 2030, but to increase the ambition of how much they're planning to reduce emissions and all the other parts of the agreement that we've talked about already, and also have some credible paths for mid-century for actually sort of moving towards this net zero target that we've talked about already. And that's going to be a critical point, really, to test, will this ratchet mechanism work? Can we get a good outcome there? It's a massive challenge, but I think one that's going to be really important that succeeds for the future of the Paris Agreement going into the next several decades.
Thank you. Freddie?
I think one of the big achievements of the Paris Agreement is that it not only says there is common but differentiated responsibility, but that it actually, in the way that the framework is set up, has this justice and fairness element in the way that the whole agreement is set up. And I think that is hugely important and a big step forward and will help on this messy way a lot. And also the fact that it recognizes that there are losses and that there are countries and states that are really losing out already on climate change. I think that is also really important. Well, and Richard has already said that net zero is that it actually says we need to have net zero emissions, not just a temperature goal that we by some fancy ways achieve, but actually that means net zero is really important. I think the next step is now really interpreting what net zero and really understanding what net zero means.
Right. I mean, one thing about net zero, I take it, is that can be applied at an individual country level, whereas the temperature goal is a global one. So it kind of pins countries down more. Is that right?
Well, that is right. Yeah, you can have, and I think you should have eventually a net zero goal for your nation, whereas a temperature goal for your nation doesn't make that much sense because, well, the atmosphere is a global thing. I haven't actually thought about that, but that's also really, really good about it. But it just says that, well, we have to stop emitting additional carbon. Full stop. That is important. But as I said, I don't think we have quite understood what that means.
Suganda.
And I think really following on from that is where the elephant in the room lies. How do we really do net zero? And as I mentioned before, fossil fuels is not explicitly in the text of the Paris Agreement. So looking forward, what I would hope is that there is more emphasis on how we tackle fossil fuels, how we manage to quit our fossil fuel habit, and how we transform the business model and the supply chains that are built around the fossil fuel industry. And this is a big task, but it's something we need to invest our resources and thinking into as soon as possible, because really this is the elephant in the room. This is what we need to tackle now.
And are we going to need another agreement to do that? Something beyond Paris?
It's quite likely. I think there's a lot of vested interests. There are a lot of powerful lobby groups. To put this into context, I mean, the fossil fuel lobby group, according to some estimates, controls between $10 to $20 trillion worth of assets. So this is actually comparable to the slave owners back in the day. And we know the abolition of slavery resulted in a civil war and lots of payouts. So we should not underestimate the power of this lobby group. So certainly there needs to be a mode of productive engagement. A lot of the research at the Oxford Martin School is figuring out how to engage with this lobby group to have productive discussions. And not only focusing on countries, but also the companies that are invested into this resource. What do we do about them? Some of them are developing countries and have been banking on this asset for their development. So I think these are open questions. There's a lot of good research already happening, but we need to have more conversation by scientists, economists, political scientists, and so on.
Well, thank you again. That's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My thanks again to Freddie, Richard and Suganda for their time today. I do hope this episode of Future Makers inspires further conversations. If you enjoyed it, we'd really appreciate if you could tell just one other person about the podcast. Or lots! Shout it out the window! The more people who listen to Future Makers, the more we can keep making it. Next time, we'll be talking about the role of nuclear energy in our sustainable future. It's bound to be another explosive topic, but I know our panellists will power on through. Until then, I'm Peter Millikan, and you've been listening to Future Makers.